Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Maricopa County is testing out a parental control program in a county library, but some critics worry it could lead to more restrictions. And what led to one of the country's biggest for-profit hospital operators going bankrupt? But first, the future of groundwater has once again been a big topic of debate this year at the state capitol. But again, as in past years, there hasn't been agreement between the GOP-led legislature and Governor Katie Hobbs about the best way to handle the issue. And on top of that, Attorney General Chris Mays has sued a foreign company, accusing it of creating a public nuisance because of the amount of groundwater it's pumping to grow alfalfa. With me now to talk more about all this is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. Once again, we've proved that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting.
Seriously. So let's go back into the Wayback Machine briefly here to the 1980 Groundwater Management Act, which at the time was a really big deal, but has kind of led us to where we are now, right?
Well, it has. I mean, there was an understanding in the late 70s when they started crafting the Groundwater Act, that the most serious concerns were in the urban areas. And that's why they created five initial active management areas, where the desire was to limit the amount of pumping, particularly since some of the areas will have access or did have access to CAP water, and to say to folks, you have to find other ways to save. Now, there was always an understanding that you could create future AMAs. And in fact, they did do that in Douglas, by their own vote. Wilcox had one imposed on them. But the problem has become AMAs are fairly rigid structures. And you don't necessarily have as much local input as you'd like to have. In fact, the AMAs are created, in most cases, by the Department of Water Resources. And folks don't like having Tom Buschatsky, who's the director there, saying, here's how you're going to do it. So they've been trying to figure out how do they deal with the problem. As you point out, there are certain areas in Arizona where they're overgrafting groundwater. There's ground subsidence in the Wilcox area, in La Paz County. They're going ahead and they're, losing water for wells are drying up. Mm-hmm. And so the trick has been, how do you find something that works in rural areas that rural residents like, but still preserves water?
Well, and Howie, this has been a fairly big topic of discussion at the Capitol, and there have been a number of ideas that have been put forward both by Republican legislators, also by Governor Katie Hobbs and her task force, but they can't really seem, the two sides, or maybe more than two sides, can't really seem to get on the same page in terms of how best to make sure that there is groundwater going forward and no one entity is pumping too much of it.
Well, exactly. And part of the issue from the governor's perspective is you're putting out forest fires. I know that's sort of a mixed metaphor there.
Yeah.
With little things, you're trying to say, well, we'll let this area form a water improvement district so that they can drill deeper wells and maybe have it go to a standpipe where people can pick up their water and put it into their vehicles. There are issues in terms of modified AMAs where you're going ahead and forming some sort of regulation. And so what the governor's done is the only thing within her power, which is to form full-blown AMAs like in Gila Bend and in Wilcox. Mm-hmm. But it's really hard to come up with something comprehensive that works statewide. And she has vetoed a series of bills this year, which she said, you're just kicking the can down the road. You're avoiding the issue. And sometimes the lawmakers have even proposed exceptions. For example, there was a bill that said we're going to allow grape growers in Wilcox to go ahead and continue taking water because, well, that's important to industry. The governor wants to use a Trump expression, one big grand bill, but it's really hard to put everything behind that because there are so many diverse interests. So all she can do, really, besides telling her water director to form AMAs is viewed with alarm. In fact, she's going later this week to stand just outside the Fondamonte Farm in western Arizona near Vicksburg and complain about lawmakers. Now, this gets the issue of, is there another option? And that's where Chris Mays comes in.
Right. Well, so let's talk about that, because she has sued Fondamonte on this idea, which has not really been used in this way before, that they're creating a public nuisance by the amount of groundwater they're pumping.
Exactly. Even Mays admits what Fondamonte is doing, what all rural farmers are doing, is legal. Under Arizona law, if you have property, you are pretty much entitled to pump as much groundwater as you can reasonably use. Now, that ignores the fact that groundwater isn't just beneath your property and you know, never mind the neighbors, but the crafters of the Arizona law have said, well, it doesn't matter if you dewater your neighbor's yard because of the fact that you're using it and you were perhaps using it first, even if you have the biggest well and the longest straw. So she's using the theory that you are creating a public nuisance by going ahead and drying up your neighbor's wells, by having land subsidence. And as you point out, this is an untested theory. It has never been used in Arizona before in a successful method. She has, you know, some theories about it, and you know, she may very well be correct. But her other problem is now you find other farmers in other cities who are saying, wait, if she succeeds in going against an unpopular company, Fondamonte is a Saudi company, and they're probably, you know, real easy target from a PR perspective, do we become next? You know, once she has that precedent, who will she use it against? Will she use it against the city of Holbrook? Will she use it against some farm operation up in northwest Arizona? And so this is going to be one big major issue that eventually is going to wind up with the Arizona Supreme Court. They're going to have to decide what to do. Because my assumption is we will not come up with a comprehensive water plan in the Arizona legislature in the near future.
All right. Well, lots to keep our eyes on, as always. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you.
You're welcome.
The bill the U.S. House of Representatives approved last week that includes much of President Trump's domestic agenda includes new work requirements for Medicaid, the health care program for low-income Americans. Critics of the proposal worry about potential cuts to Medicaid. An analysis done last week by the Kaiser Family Foundation estimated the bill would lead to around 230,000 Arizonans on Medicaid losing their coverage. GOP supporters of the bill argue they're not cutting Medicaid, but instead are rooting out, quote, fraud, waste, and abuse. Fewer people on Medicaid would likely have a big impact on hospitals who are required to care for patients regardless of whether or not they have insurance. With me to talk about all this is Dr. Robert Trenchell, President and CEO of Onvida Health in Yuma. Dr. Trenchell, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for being here. So I'm curious, when you look at this proposal that has passed the House, now moving to the Senate, what might it mean for you and your facility?
Well, you know, the bill's moved very quickly, obviously, and, you know, there's been some last-minute amendments, and we really don't know the full impact of those. So, you know, first, I just want to make sure we urge the Senate to really take a long, hard look at this, consult with their constituency, healthcare providers, hospitals, to see how it's going to impact them. You know, the work requirement that's in the bill today, we believe will disproportionately impact rural areas like us in Yuma that rely heavily on agriculture because, you know, are many of the individuals that work here that are on Medicaid work in the agricultural industry, and that is not a year-round opportunity for them. Mm-hmm. You know, they only work part of the year, and then the rest of the year they may be uncovered. And we know that healthcare needs don't go away just because you don't have health insurance. So, you know, we're going to be obligated to treat those individuals, which we happily do, but we need a payer source for those individuals as well. And this could severely impact that, which would severely impact the services we provide to the entire our entire service area, which is a little over 7,000 square miles.
So when you look at what the potential impact could be, and again, you know, there's a lot in this bill that hasn't quite been unpacked. The Senate is, you know, there's a lot of Republican senators are saying we're going to make some changes to this. So the caveat being we don't know exactly what the final version of this bill will be. But as it stands now, how would you compare the potential impact to maybe what, you know, rural hospitals like yours were talking about, you know, more than a decade ago before Arizona expanded Medicaid?
Yeah, not dissimilar. You know, it's not dissimilar. We've had the expanded Medicaid population in Arizona, which has been great. Arizona's never imposed a work requirement. So, you know, we don't really know the full impact. What we do know is that it will be less and eventually be more and more less because inflation goes up, the cost of providing care goes up. And if we continue to absorb all those costs without a compensatory, some type of offset from a revenue perspective, then, you know, we're looking at making cuts in the organization for really the most vulnerable people because those are our biggest loss losers in the organization. And we sustain those because we are relatively healthy financially, but as soon as you start impacting that with cuts to Medicaid, it impacts the entire health system. That's what a lot of people don't understand. They say, well, if you just cut Medicaid, you're just impacting, you know, those poor people who don't want to work, which, by the way, is just not true. You know, every person we've ever seen and treated on Medicaid is, you know, if they can work, they do. And, you know, there's no abuse in the system, obviously, that we see. But the issue is that cuts in Medicaid are going to impact maternity care. Even if you're not a Medicaid patient, it's going to impact behavioral health services. Even if you're not a Medicaid patient, our neonatal ICU, you know, those are our biggest loss leaders in the organization. So when you cut Medicaid, we're also going to concomitantly look at where do we have to make cuts in the system to absorb that. And unfortunately, it's usually the most vulnerable that get hit, and that's not something that we want to do. But we also know that rural safety net hospitals like ours, we're the only source that people have here. We're 180 miles away from getting the same level of care that we provide here. You either have to go to Phoenix or San Diego to get the same level of care you get here. Wow. So if we close those services, I mean, I don't even know if people can get there.
Do you have a sense of what percentage of your patients are on Medicaid?
Yeah, 24%.
Wow,
of our
almost
patients
a quarter.
Are on Medicaid. Yes, it's significant. 85% of our individuals are government pay. So it's Medicaid, Medicare, and, you know, CHAMPIS, TRICARE, and that. So we rely heavily on governmental funding. So any wobble in that affects our system significantly and consequently the care we provide for our community.
Right. I want to ask you about something that House Speaker Mike Johnson said in response to some of these questions about cutting Medicaid. And he said, and I'm going to paraphrase it, that it's a moral choice that lawmakers were making, Republican lawmakers, the ones who voted for it in this case, are making, that, you know, able-bodied adults who are on Medicaid have an obligation to be working or looking for work. I'm curious, and you kind of alluded to this a little earlier, I'm curious what you make of that argument.
Well, you know, work is good. I mean, and, you know, people wanting to work gives them a sense of purpose, and it's a laudable goal. Unfortunately, you know, you look at the federal poverty level, $32,000 for a family of four. I mean, I don't know who can survive on that, but I guess some people do. And it's just a tragedy that we think, you know, supporting individuals that need health care, is a moral obligation to provide that health care. It is a moral obligation to give those people access to health care. I would argue just the opposite side of that.
So understanding, again, that nobody really knows what the final outcome is going to be, how are you and how are your colleagues trying to prepare for potential changes coming down the line, not really knowing what they might be?
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's a big challenge because if you don't know what those changes are, then, you know, all you can do is prepare based on what you think may happen, and that may not be the case. But we are going through those scenarios. Many of my colleagues around the state are doing the exact same thing. You know, if we get this amount of cut, then what is that going to mean? You know, what are the services that we have to look at? Because it all comes down to services and people. I mean, it's not like you can just trim a little fat off the system. There is no fat. I mean, healthcare operates on a 2-3% margin. So in a good year. So any wobble is just going to cause a significant impact across the system.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Dr. Robert Trenchel, President and CEO of Onvita Health in Yuma. Dr. Trenchel, thanks so much for your insights. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. Bye-bye.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the Tucson Unified School District has pledged to take the next step in a climate action plan that was created by students. We'll hear from one of those students who led the project. But first, the Maricopa County Library District is in the midst of a pilot project at its Queen Creek Library, which aims to allow parents to have more of a say in what books their kids check out. Under the program, parents can go to the library and fill out a form listing specific titles they don't want their kids to check out. This applies to families in which the kids' library account is linked to their parents. Officials say they'll solicit feedback from library district staff and look at it over the summer, and that if it seems to be going well, the program could be expanded to other libraries. Supporters compare this to the kind of parental controls you might find on phones and tablets, restricting websites or apps their kids can use. But critics worry it's more of a slippery slope. We have two perspectives on this today, starting with Thomas Galvin, chair of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. He came by the studio recently to talk about this, and I asked what the thought process was behind formulating this policy. What problem was the board trying to solve?
Yeah, well, you know, people hear about the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors and always wondering what we do, but we actually serve on a variety of different boards. Some of them get more news than others, including for Chase Field, we sit and operate the stadium district, but we also sit and operate the library district. And what we do is we work with towns and municipalities and cities throughout the valley, but in some cases we operate our own libraries. And so in this instance, we operate a library in Queen Creek. And what we do is try to be responsive to different questions or concerns that we hear from different members of the community. In a county of 4.5 million people, there's a wide variety of opinions, and different towns and municipalities have different issues. So what we're doing here is a pilot program for just one of the libraries.
Had you been hearing complaints from folks in and around Queen Creek about parents being worried about their kids checking out certain books?
We have, and we've heard concerns and complaints from parents throughout the county, but we definitely are hearing it more than others in Queen Creek. And so what we try to do is create programs or ideas, or in this case, a pilot program that are responsive to that particular community.
So obviously there's been a lot of discussion over the past number of years about libraries and what should or should not be in them. I'm wondering if the program that you put in place was a compromise, if there are other ideas on the table that maybe you decided not to go with in favor of this?
Yeah, well, I think one thing people need to understand, and I think a lot of people appreciate this, is that there's a difference between a public library and curriculum at schools. And so a lot of news attention that we hear about regarding libraries is curriculum in schools and how schools really, what books they put in their libraries. We're a public library. We're not in the business of banning books. We're not in the business of denying books that people want to access. But what this program doing, it's a pilot program for parents. And the program is the parent comes in and signs a form in the library. Come in, actually sign a physical form. Show and prove that you are the parent or legal guardian of that kid. You have ID. You have to show that. And also let us know the title of the book that you do not want your child to have access to. This allows parents to be proactive, and it's not the county being reactive.
So in this case, I couldn't go in and to the library and say, I don't want my kid reading this genre of book. It has to be a specific title that the librarian would then, or the system would not allow my child to check out.
Right, for checking out. And so this book would be tied to your account, which is tied to your child. So if there's a book that you want to make sure that your child is not bringing home, you're just letting them know. And so this is the parent controlling the account of their own child, which to me respects parental rights, but also respects the rights of other people who, if they do want to access the book or don't have an issue of their child accessing the book, can do so. I think this is a win-win for all sides.
Is there anything to stop a child who maybe knows that their parent has a particular book on this list, or maybe they don't know, from just taking the book off the shelf and sitting at a table and reading it?
Well, that also comes down to parental responsibility, right? My wife and I are raising a young son, and for us, we have to be very careful, and it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we know what our child is accessing, especially with screen time. This is tablets, this is television, computers, and of course, our cell phones, which are just right there at a moment's notice. A child can just pick it up. But when you have your child at the library, I would think ostensibly that you're nearby or you're going to make sure that your child is with someone responsible. But this is about the checking out of books. That's all this program does. And once again, it's a pilot program being tested at one library, just started on May 1st. So we don't even have information or statistics yet on how it's going. But we think this is something that's worthwhile to help parents just be more comfortable with how their kids are checking out books from libraries.
It kind of raises the question, though, based on what you said, that ostensibly a parent would be either with their child or have the child at the library with somebody they trust. If that's the case, what's the need for having a restriction on what the child can check out?
Yeah, well, sometimes kids are able to check out a whole pile of books. And I remember when I went to the library with my brother, there was a whole bunch of books that I would love to check out and bring home. You know, to be honest, my mom didn't probably look at all of them, but these were Encyclopedia Brown or The Great Brain,
yeah,
or, you know, Beverly Cleary books. But there are parents out there who obviously have concerns because, once again, their child is in a government facility. It's in a public facility. If this helps the parent feel more comfortable or feel more secure what their child is accessing or seeing from a library, then my answer is why not? And for any critics of our program, I don't know what their criticism could be, because this is self-directed from that family. No one else is affected. If you do not want to participate in the pilot program, you have nothing to worry about.
So you mentioned the idea of school curriculums before. I'm curious if the fact that this is, as you say, a public library versus even a school library, does that change the calculus in how you went about trying to craft this policy?
Yes, because we have to comply with the law, right? We have to observe the First Amendment, and we cannot just declare what we're going to, you know, ban this book or we're going to ban that book because it's a slippery slope. What one family might like, another family may not like. So it's a balancing act. We also, of course, have to consult with our attorneys, and we're represented by the county attorney's office. So everything we do is above board and legal. So if there's anyone who is going to hurl accusations at us that says that we're going to do something that's veering on the side of censorship or book banning, I'm just going to say to them, you know what? We had to have this vetted by our county attorney's office. This is above board.
So you mentioned the risk of a slippery slope here, and I could imagine some people might think, okay, well, you're doing this pilot project now. Like, it doesn't seem like that big of a stretch to say, okay, if this is successful in some people's eyes, maybe taking books off the shelves might be next. Is that something that you would support in any way?
Well, I don't think I think that is a stretch. I don't think that is something that people should be concerned about. What you have seen as a board, because obviously we get pressures on each side, right? So if there's a group of people or if there's a constituency that says you guys need to ban these books, we've categorically rejected that. Once again, we're not going to be violating people's constitutional rights. At the end, we are a governmental body operating a public library. Since the time of Benjamin Franklin, this has been going on. So this program, I think, is something that should be praised and should be celebrated and should be emulated around the country if it's successful.
How do you define success for something like this?
A success is if parents come back to us and say, hey, we found this very helpful. One of the things is if parents are going to come to us and complain that we have these books, we're going to say to them, hey, did you sign up for this list? It holds people accountable if they're going to be lodging complaints against the library district for even having these books. But if your argument is like, hey, I'm concerned that my child is going to check this out, we're going to say, well, under this pilot program in this jurisdiction, there's an ability for you to make sure that your child doesn't check it out.
Thomas Galvin is chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. Despite his assurances the program is not a step toward censorship, my next guest is still worried about that. Brody Hubbard is a writer and parent of two elementary school age kids in Queen Creek. When I spoke with him earlier, I asked what his concern is with this pilot project.
My concern with the parental choice program, which I actually think is better titled parental restriction program, is I have fundamental issues with it based on the recommendations of librarians and library associations, but I also do not trust the architects of this measure, and by that I mean specifically the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors.
So are you concerned that they might expand the scope of what they're doing now, or maybe expand what they're doing now to other places?
I think if you look at who makes up the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors and the groups they have sought out to discuss literature with, it's very clear, very transparent what kind of books that they're targeting and that they do intend to expand this program, expand the restrictions, and expand the measure across the state.
So I spoke earlier with Maricopa County Supervisor Thomas Galvin, and he basically said, we're not looking to take books off the shelf. Like, I'm not in favor of that. We're not going to do that. It sounds like you're not entirely convinced.
I would like to believe that Galvin is telling the truth, but unfortunately, we look at his buddy Debbie Lesko and her conversations with the Arizona Women of Action, and I can't trust that there is more on the horizon with this as far as what they're looking to ban and, well, sorry, restrict. They're calling it restriction. They're calling it parental choice, but I think this pilot program is a slippery slope.
Well, so let me ask you about this program specifically, because the way it works is a parent who doesn't want their kid to check out a book goes in and writes down the specific title of the book, and that gets input into the system. But for a parent like you, who it sounds like you don't have concerns about what your kids are reading or don't want to restrict what they're reading, you just don't participate in this, and your kid is free to check out whatever they want.
Well, let me be clear. I don't think that opposing the parental choice program means it's a free-for-all. It just means that librarians should not be put in the position to enforce restrictions when really it's the job of parents to be involved in their kids' lives and have conversations with them about what they're checking out, what they're reading. And I think we just need to be a little more realistic about what's actually on the library shelves. The proponents of this measure are acting like it's pornography on the shelves. And that's just not the case. It's not the kind of books that are being targeted by measures like this. It's overall books about Black history, about LGBTQ issues. It's books with protagonists of color, women of color primarily. Those are the books that are on these lists that people like Debbie Lesko and groups like Arizona Women of Action are compiling.
Well, supporters of this, though, say this is not putting librarians in the middle. It's letting parents say, I don't want my child to check this out. And when they go to check out, the system says, sorry, child, you're not allowed to, with librarians not really being involved in it.
If a parent doesn't want their kid to check something out, then that parent should be involved enough to have that conversation with their kid. When you impose that restriction on the librarians to enforce, which whether it's a librarian doing it in person or the technology doing it, that is pushing off that responsibility onto the library.
So it sounds like what you're saying is, for example, if one of your children went to the library, you would be with them. And if they wanted to check out a book that maybe you didn't think was age appropriate or content appropriate or anything like that, you would have a conversation with them about why that is, as opposed to putting it on this list to say, okay, you're just not allowed to check it out. It sounds like you're saying that parents should have those conversations as opposed to signing up for this program and forcing the library to sort of get in the middle of it. Am I hearing you correctly on that?
Absolutely. I believe it's up to the parent to make the effort and be involved in their kids' lives and educations, and they should know what their kids are doing, what they're interested in. But even if they're not, what about the kids who come from horribly oppressive households that want to restrict everything? The library should be an oasis, a center for rescue from that, where they can go explore ideas that maybe their parents don't agree with. Maybe it's okay for our kids to have their own ideas, but I'm not even concerned about inappropriate things on the shelves. That's kind of a myth. That's kind of a smokescreen for what proponents of these measures, of these restrictions, are actually trying to keep out of the hands of our kids.
How big of a topic of conversation is this in your town? Like, have you talked to friends or neighbors who either have signed up for certain books on this list or have decided not to?
I will concede that the group of people I know and talk to might not look like your typical conservative Queen Creek resident. And so my friends, many of them who are educators and librarians, you know, none of us are signing up our kids for this. None of us are worried about our kids getting something terrible off the shelf, and we're not going to make up a restriction list. And we also, you know, frankly, don't mind. We encourage, in fact, if they do read books and stories about people who are not like them, you know? And so the conversations I've had find this measure kind of scary.
Brody Hubbard is a writer and parent of two elementary school-age kids living in Queen Creek. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Steward Healthcare was among the country's biggest for-profit hospital operators. At its peak, it ran dozens of hospitals in 10 states, including Florence Hospital and St. Luke's Behavioral Health Center, among others, here in Arizona. But last May, Steward declared bankruptcy. Since then, most of those hospitals have been sold and several have closed. Hannah Leventova has been looking into some of the factors that led to Steward's bankruptcy and how that impacted its hospital's patients. Part of that included a review of every malpractice, wrongful death, and personal injury case filed in federal or state court against Steward. There were more than 450 lawsuits involving 83 patient deaths. Leventova is an investigative reporter at Mother Jones, and she joins me to talk about some of what she found. And Hannah, how big of a deal was the company's for-profit status to what happened and what you found in your reporting?
So for-profit can come in a lot of different forms, right? What was significant in Steward's case was that Steward began as a small nonprofit hospital chain in Massachusetts. It was called something else. A private equity firm called Cerberus bought it in 2010, and they created Steward. And then from there, they did a number of financial transactions to expand it nationally. Steward was created by investors, by private equity investors that have a very aggressive investment model that's focused on very quick, very high returns. That's the piece of the for-profit adjective here that I think is important to remember.
Well, and what's really interesting is that in many cases, maybe specifically for nonprofit hospitals, the margins are really tight. Like, hospitals are not necessarily, in many cases, a money-making operation. So it's interesting that private equity firms were getting into this business with that understanding. And it seems like, at least in Stewart's case and maybe others, that it didn't really mesh with the model of running a successful hospital with good patient outcomes.
Yeah, it is interesting because you're right. All hospitals do run pretty lean budgets. They run on pretty lean margins. And in the case of Steward, they bought a lot of hospitals that were in lower income communities or in more rural communities where they had a higher percentage of, you know, Medicare and Medicaid patients, which means that they're running an even leaner business, right? But notwithstanding all of that, private equity has really been expanding into all corners of healthcare, not just hospitals, in recent years. But in this case, you know, what ended up happening was it seems like the private equity firm Cerberus started to realize that the various financial transactions that they were doing, like loading Steward up with debt, were actually hurting the hospitals and causing the hospital finances to struggle. And the way that Cerberus got out and still made a killing, they nearly quadrupled their investment, was by selling off the hospital real estate, right? The most valuable thing, which is the land and the buildings. So Cerberus, the private equity firm, sold off the hospital real estate to a very wonky kind of financial vehicle called a real estate investment trust. So then those hospitals became tenants in land that they used to own. And then the proceeds from those sales helped fund this huge return when the private equity firm exited the investment.
Was it those kinds of deals that really led to the downfall of Steward in terms of, you know, paying these exorbitant rents and, you know, having to sort of cut costs and cut corners at the hospitals themselves?
I think there was sort of a cascading flood of financial transactions that kind of kept pulling Steward into further and further financial chaos, right? First, you have the private equity firm comes in, buys the chain, starts expanding it. And keep in mind, one of the ways that private equity does what it does, that they fund these big returns for themselves and for their investors, is by layering debt onto their businesses. And throughout all of this, you know, remember that the private equity firm is always taking a cut of these transactions. They pay themselves annual fees for their work managing Steward. The executives at Steward themselves were getting very well paid and getting a piece of these transactions. And then just the sale of the real estate, that was a big transaction that happened in 2016. So there's just a layering of kind of extraction from these deals that is going to the people at the top. It's going to the private equity firm. It's going to the top executives at Steward, like the CEO, who, you know, famously then, you know, bought a $40 million yacht and all of these things.
Yeah.
And then after all of that, now you're stuck with these leases. And you were running a lean operation before, right? It was already hard to be profitable when you owned the place. And now you're stuck with these very high leases that have all these, you know, escalation clauses. They're going to get higher. So it wasn't just one transaction or one financial problem. It was sort of one thing after the other after the other.
What did the folks with Cerberus or with Steward have to say about all this?
Cerberus has focused on the fact that when they owned Steward, they helped it expand, that they actually helped it grow, right? That's sort of the selling point of a lot of private equity firms, is that we come in and we're actually going to make your business better, more efficient. And it is true that when Cerberus owned Steward, Steward expanded massively. But that's because Cerberus sold the real estate of the hospitals to this real estate trust to fund that expansion, and then took a huge cut of it for themselves. So Cerberus has sort of focused on the half of the story about the growing, and they say that, you know, they're not responsible for the financial troubles that arose at Steward.
Have the Steward folks said anything about the bankruptcy or anything related to what you found?
You know, when I reached out to Steward, I never really got a clear answer, because there isn't really much of Steward left to even talk to me. In my reporting, we pulled all of these medical malpractice and personal injury and wrongful death cases. We pulled all of the cases in 9 states where Steward operated, and we found hundreds of cases. There were 83 deaths. And sort of I put all of that in front of Steward and asked them, you know, how does this connect to your business? Do you think that the business contributed to these problems in patient care? And I didn't get a straight answer.
One of the things that you reported that I thought was really striking was that in its bankruptcy, Steward owes $9 billion, billion with a B, to more than 100,000 creditors. That seems like two pretty sizable numbers.
Yes. Big chunk of that $9 billion is rent. They weren't paying medical suppliers. They weren't, in some cases, they weren't paying wages. I mean, the bankruptcy filing is just, it's just wild. You know, when I was reporting, I heard these stories about, like, in one hospital, someone came and repossessed, like, the coffee machine because they hadn't paid the coffee bill. And that's a telling detail, but, like, coffee is important, but it's not the most important thing, right? But then, you know, the story that I focused on was a case where a woman needed a life-saving device, and that device had been repossessed 3 weeks prior by the vendor because the hospital owed them over $500,000. And when I started reporting, the thing that I kept thinking about was that there are probably so many more cases like that where a supply was missing and it will never come out, right? We'll never know.
All right. That is Hannah Leventova, investigative reporter with Mother Jones. Hannah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Last year, the Tucson Unified School District voted to adopt a series of measures designed to combat climate change. The measures represent some of the most ambitious targets of any district in the country, and their adoption is largely the result of advocacy by the Arizona Youth Climate Coalition. Oja Songhi is the co-lead of AZYCC, and he's just 20 years old. As Ojas recently told my co-host Sam Dingman, his generation views climate activism with greater urgency than some of their predecessors.
when thinking about climate action and reaching net zero by 2050, our mind doesn't go to, okay, but how do we, like, what are the roadblocks to that? And how do we, like, what's all the problems to that? And like, what are reasons, you know, to like debate it? Our mind goes to, okay, we need to achieve that goal. Adults and older people, they view it as something to debate about in terms of implementation and how much money it's worth. And is it really worth not like buying an EV bus instead of a diesel bus because the diesel bus is cheaper for right now, as opposed to our view of we need to do an EV bus right now. It doesn't matter how much it costs.
Right. If I'm hearing you right, it's like in a lot of other conversations about climate, climate is sort of weighed against other factors when policy decisions are being made. It sounds like what you guys are saying in AZYCC is like, no, every decision needs to be made with saving the environment as the top priority.
Exactly. Climate isn't something that we can deprioritize or, you know, push off to later.
So the Tucson Unified School District recently voted to adopt a plan that AZYCC was a big part of putting together. Tell us what's in that plan.
So the climate action resolution that they adopted back in October is the most comprehensive school climate action resolution in the entire country. It commits the whole district to net zero emissions across all three scopes of emissions by 2040. And it has specific measures and dates in there, such as 100% clean energy by 2030, 100% electric vehicles by 2035, zero waste by 2040.
So when you say three scopes of emissions, what does that mean?
Yeah, so there's three scopes of greenhouse gas emissions. The first scope is all of the direct emissions. So how much emissions come from their buses that burn gas? The second scope of emissions is from energy that they use or they purchase. So all the energy that they purchase from TEP, how many emissions is that causing?
TEP is Tucson Electric and Power?
Yeah. And TEP uses 80% coal and gas. So that's a lot of emissions.
Wow.
And then the scope three emissions for TUSD is everything else up and down the supply chain. So when we buy food from a supplier, how much emissions were produced in the creation of that, in the using of the fertilizer and the creation of the fertilizer? And when we throw it away and it decomposes in a landfill, how many emissions is that creating? When you buy a wood desk and you cut down a tree, how many emissions does that create? All of that is in scope three.
So when it comes then to the electrification of the school bus fleets, which the district is pledging to get to 100% electric school buses by 2040, is that what you said?
Yeah.
By 2040. How close are they right now? Do they have any electric school buses currently?
They have a few electric buses. It's a weird mix of they are taking really strong climate action by adopting this resolution, but at the same time, their bond that was approved in 2023, $480 million for capital improvements, they're using some of that money to buy 20 new diesel buses. That purchase was approved before they adopted their resolution.
Okay.
And so, you know, they're not willingly, you know, blatantly going back on their promises. So whether or not we can undo that procurement process that has already started is kind of up in the air.
So the earliest targets in this plan are 2030. This is all very soon. How much is it going to cost to implement the changes that are going to be necessary to make all this happen?
That we're not sure of quite yet.
Mm-hmm.
Over the next, I believe, 18 months, they're going to be creating a climate action plan, an implementation plan for the district staff. And they'd also be conducting a cost-benefit analysis. So it's going to be with their professional help that we're going to be able to figure out how much this costs. I can say that in other school districts across the country that have gone net zero energy or that have conducted climate action, the cost savings from clean energy and energy efficiency has always far exceeded the cost it took to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And so every school district that has done that has seen cost savings.
So I have to ask, Ogis, I mean, a very ambitious plan like this that centers climate change as a dangerous thing that needs to be worked against by way of these very aggressive measures to counteract its effects. It is out of step with a lot of the national trends that we're seeing around climate change. What do you make of that contrast?
I think it's really disappointing. It's going to kill a lot of people. I think it is a testament to the fact that climate action has to be done nationally, but also locally. You know, even as the national government is attacking climate action, we're making meaningful, substantial progress at the local level.
Could I have you describe just physically what it was like spending time in India when you were a kid?
Yeah, it really felt like, especially in the months when it was the most polluted, when you step outside, I felt like I was in pain and that I felt like I was actively harming my lungs every time I took a breath. I remember, like, we would wear masks when we went outside. I remember being driven to school and the smog was so thick that you could only see the hazards of the cars in front.
Wow.
I remember, yeah, you couldn't see anything. And I remember hearing about pileups that happened on the freeways there because no one can see anything just because it's so polluted. And people would wheeze and cough all the time. One day of pollution in Delhi is equal to smoking multiple cigarettes. And I lived there for 8 years. And you know, you live with this burden and it feels like, why are we not solving this? Like, someone has to do something. And then I moved to the US for high school and I'm just, you know, dumbstruck by how much better the environment is here. I can breathe freely. I can see the stars. And I think that really made me realize at a core level how important environmental quality is and how much of an impact environmental degradation has on one's quality of life and also on what people can even envision for their future.
Well, Ojas Sanghi is the co-lead of the Arizona Youth Climate Coalition. Ojas, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.